Runoff, a crime novel about election fraud, evokes a curious timelessness of classic detective fiction. A noir gem, says Mystery Scene Magazine. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 29, Pizza Party. After finishing with Chow, I caught the number 30 Stockton bus to Lombard Street near Van Ness Avenue, where a lot of the cheaper tourist motels were located. I picked the Golden Gate Motor Lodge and asked for a room for three nights from a clerk who was spelunking his mouth with a bent paper clip. I spoke in halting English and gave my name as Ronald Olson, allowing him to overcharge me $50 when I held my wallet open and professed uncertainty about the right denomination of bills to be used for payment.
All the money is green, I said. In Sweden, we have different colors and sizes.
But only one kind of meatball, said the clerk. He gave me a key for a first-floor room next to the ice maker and the concrete stairwell. Inside was a carpet with the sort of pattern you see when slime mold grows on split pea soup, and several badly done imitations of the paintings of the kids with big eyes. There was also a bed with a sagging mattress that enveloped your butt like gel in a dental mold, and a TV with one of the color guns on the fritz. The stains on the ceiling looked worse than most people's garage floors. I sat on the bed and watched a magenta-colored newscaster from the local station read the evening news. The murder of Kathleen Wilmont and her brother was given big play. They showed a clip of Padilla giving an emotional tribute to them, followed by a promise to dedicate the election victory to their memory. He lambasted the current administration, and by implication Loudon, saying that they were ultimately responsible for the Wilmont's death because of insufficient focus by the SFPD on major crime. He ended with an impassioned plea for voters to turn out tomorrow for Kathleen and Caleb. Then came the part I was dreading. They showed a clip of what looked like an impromptu news conference given by Lieutenant Kittredge. He stonewalled most of the questions. Was the murder politically motivated? Is there a connection to the death of Elections Director Bowman? Can you comment on rumors regarding S&M paraphernalia at the crime scene? And only gave the barest sketch of the circumstances of the body's discovery. However, when asked if there were any suspects, he replied,
"No active suspects, but we want to interview Private Investigator August Reardon as a person of interest."
Even if the ballistics hadn't come back yet, there was plenty to tie me in. My call to campaign headquarters and my cab ride to the crime scene for openers. And that didn't even factor in the possibility that I'd been ID'd by the patrol cop who drove by the house. I mashed down the power button on the lunchbox-sized remote that went with the motel's Paleolithic-era TV and excavated my butt from the mattress. I didn't need to hear any more. What I needed was to compare notes with Chris and get some food. I retrieved a well-thumbed Yellow Pages from the laminated nightstand and flipped it open to the pizza listings. A bunch of clipped toenails fell out. That put a dent in my appetite to the extent that I refrained from ordering a large, but didn't stop me from getting a medium double meat stromboli. I was too paranoid to phone Chris from the hotel, and I had turned off my cell phone to avoid being tracked by it. So I walked to a corner gas station and used a payphone.
"August!" Chris shouted into the receiver when he realized it was me. "Do you know that you're a wanted man? The police are looking for you."
"Oh, really?" I said. "Then it's a good thing I'm calling from a payphone on my way out of town. Now go find another and dial this number." When he rang back, I explained I was kidding about leaving town and gave him directions to the motor lodge, emphasizing that he be very careful not to be followed. I hung up then and went to the station mini-mart to get a six-pack to go with a pizza. The pie arrived well before Chris did. I was working my way through my third slice, orange grease from the pepperoni coating my fingers, when he knocked at the door. I wiped my hands on the complimentary shoe buffer provided by the motel and let him in. He was dressed in a dark blue pea jacket with a matching watch cap. "You were supposed to make sure you weren't followed," I said, "not dress up like a character from On the Waterfront." "I was trying to be less conspicuous." "It is better than a spangled Elvis suit." I rebuttoned the door and pointed to the pizza and beer on the bed. "Grab yourself a slice. You longshoremen must work up big appetites." He looked down at the congealing pizza like he was taking in a frog on a dissection tray. "Gross, August. You know I don't eat processed meat." "It's free-range sausage." "I'm not touching it." "Have a brewski then." He pulled off his watch cap, folded it, and set it carefully down on the nightstand. "Being a fugitive hasn't improved your sense of humor. Is there coffee?" "There's a coffee maker and a tray of fixings on the vanity, but I'm not sure I would recommend it." He walked over to the vanity and reached a timid hand out to pick up a plastic spoon. It was stuck to the tray. He shivered and sat down demurely on a wobbly straight-backed chair with a furry orange seat cushion. "You should give yourself up, August. Jail would be preferable." I slumped onto the bed and grabbed another slice of the pie. "You may have a point." "So," he asked, "what the hell is going on?" I filled him in on the events since I'd seen him at the hospital, including my adventure on Guyberger's boat, the debacle on August Alley, and my conversations with Calder and Chow. "So," he asked, "what the hell is going on?" I laughed. "I have some ideas. Tell me what you found out at CVT, and maybe we can piece it together." "Happy to, but I'm afraid all I'll be doing is supplying another piece that doesn't quite fit. I told you they figured out there was a logic bomb. I got an engineer on the staff, a very cute engineer, by the way, to open up about the details. Problem is, they've only got part of it figured out." "Well, tell me what they've figured out, and keep your fantasy life to yourself." Chris stuck his tongue out. "Remember I told you a logic bomb is a malicious bit of code that's hidden in the regular software?"
"Yeah."
"Well, just like a real bomb, it needs a sort of trigger. Turns out the trigger for this logic bomb is the ballot definition file, which is really just a list of candidates and propositions formatted in a special way that the voting machine can read and display on its screen. When that file has a trigger set for a particular candidate, the logic bomb goes off, and the machine will ensure that the candidate receives a majority of the votes registered on the machine's memory, regardless of how the votes are cast. If it's not set for any candidate, then the machine works the way it's supposed to, recording votes accurately."
"Why not just build a preference for your candidate in the logic bomb up front? Why go to the trouble of separating the trigger out in the ballot file? Seems indirect."
"Because if you do it that way, you can use the logic bomb over and over to rig elections. All you need to do is set the trigger in the ballot file for the candidate you want to win before the ballot's loaded onto the machines. You don't have to reprogram the software on the machines, which are subject to a lot more scrutiny than the ballot, and may not be updated between elections."
"All right, I get it, but you just talked about changing the votes on the USB drives. Does the bomb change the votes on the audit trail too?"
"It's very clever about that. Sometimes it does, which risks the voter noticing the discrepancy. But the engineer told me that only about 3 out of every 100 voters notices if there's a difference between the votes cast and the votes printed on the audit trail. Other times it doesn't change the vote on the audit trail. But as I told you before, the chances of someone discovering a discrepancy by unspooling one of those little rolls and manually counting the votes is pretty low. Either way, the logic bomb makes sure enough votes are registered for the selected candidate."
"And they're sure Guyberger was the one who did it."
"Yep, he's the only one who had the skill and access to pull it off. I threw a rind of pizza crust back into the box and looked down at the remainder a little queasily. So what's the problem? Sounds like they found the smoking gun. What don't they know? Chris smiled and put his hands into the pockets of his pea jacket. He tipped his chair back against the wall. They haven't figured out how the ballot is secretly marked. And because of that, they don't even know that the logic bomb was triggered during the November election. When they looked at the old ballot file, they couldn't tell which, if any, candidate was secretly flagged to win. So all this is hypothetical? It's real enough, but since they aren't certain it was used, they are not about to go public with the problem. And it seems to me it's entirely possible it wasn't used. You said you found a precinct map on Geiberger's boat with election totals that had Loudon as the clear winner. Maybe that was Geiberger's real plan, but he got tripped up somehow. I nodded and guzzled what was left in my current can of Bud. I've got a theory about the precinct map. I think Geiberger was approached by Calder to fix the election, and I think Calder's original instructions were to make sure Loudon won hands down. Then Calder began worrying about Loudon cleaning house at the Department of Building Inspections, and he decided to switch sides. Chow said Calder and Wood were mirror images of each other. I think Calder approached Wood and made a deal to divvy up the development at Hunter's Point. Then they told Geiberger to fix it so Padilla got enough votes to force a runoff. They knew it would be too obvious to have him win in the general election, but they figured it would be okay to have him squeak by in the runoff. How do you explain the Wilmot's murder and your being set up for it? Wilmot must have done what I asked and started checking into Wood's involvement in the election fraud and found something. Wood found out and decided she and her brother had to go. They framed me for it to get me out of the picture too. But why did Calder also try to kill you on Geiberger's boat? I grinned at him. I knew you were going to ask that. I'm pretty sure the thing with the boat only happened because I was snooping around. My guess is they were going to sink the boat that night anyway, to destroy whatever evidence Geiberger might have left behind. But when I didn't take the bribe Calder offered, they decided to tie me into the doings at August Alley. Either that, or Wood acted without consulting Calder. He's definitely the more hard-boiled of the two. Chris pursed his lips and raised his shoulders in a gesture that signaled it was remotely possible. Fine, but explain Bowman's murder. And Wu, how does Wu fit into your unified theory of mayhem? I crumpled up the beer can and threw it at the trash can in the bathroom. It sailed high and landed with an unholy clatter in the tub. Beats me. And you haven't fit Roadrunner into it either. I know. I rose from the bed with an airy belch and a false display of sang-froid. Chris made a face. I walked over to where he was sitting and levered his chair off the wall. Pull on your watch cap and let's go, I said. We're going to find Roadrunner and make him fit.
You have been listening to Runoff, a book hard-boiled great James Crumley described as a smart, funny, spooky, often touching, always entertaining romp. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.